Okay, I'm with Todd Berry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Thanks again for taking the time, Todd. Can you give us a view of the economic outlook for the next few years,
sure,
or the tax base, let's say?
Sure.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the thinking out of the State Department of Revenue in Wisconsin was that we would be beginning a recovery about now. And their forecasts over the last year and a half have kept putting that off and putting that off. So I think now it looks like next year sometime, or even 2010, and that doesn't take into account what's been happening nationally in the last few weeks. So I think the slowdown could be longer, deeper, and slower to return.
So how about, you know, other states have been in the news with their pension fund problems. Mm-hmm. Does Wisconsin have similar issues that could affect spending and taxes?
Well, we have done some things right and some things wrong. If you're talking about the public retirement system in Wisconsin, it's very well managed, very well run, and it's basically fully funded. We don't have the gaping liability that, say, Illinois has. We really are one of the better positioned states in that respect. That said, we also are a state whose retirement system may be the only one in the whole country statewide that requires no employee contribution. Mm-hmm. So it's an exceedingly rich, in quotes, system, and certainly very expensive for government. And we also have lurking, particularly in school districts, but in other places, like many other places, we have what the bean counters call OPEB liabilities, or post-retirement liabilities, that don't have anything to do with the retirement system, but many school districts in Wisconsin had basically promised retirees health insurance post-retirement, and some of those liabilities are huge. The Milwaukee Public Schools post-retirement liability, we're not talking about retirement here again, their post-retirement liability for things like health care is somewhere in the range of $2.2 to $2.5 billion.
Billion with a B, wow.
Billion with a B, yes.
Wow. How about state debt? I know, mm-hmm, California is having some difficulty, yeah, refinancing their state debt. What's,
well,
what about
we certainly,
structural deficits and all,
yeah,
that?
We certainly don't let anybody get ahead of us there. In the macro sense, if you look at all the state and local government debt relative to the size of our economy, in 1960 we were third lowest in the country. Mm. Even by 2000, we were still out of the top 20. Within the last few years, we have moved into the top 10 in the country. And when you look at why, it is really state government carrying structural deficits and gap deficits now for over a decade, and doing a lot of maneuvering, accounting tricks, and so forth to keep its budget balanced on paper. But the fact of the matter is, on the state's official financial statements, we're running a $2.44 billion gap deficit. And if you look at our net unrestricted assets, they're almost minus $9 billion. And why? Simply because the state debt has gone from $4 billion to $9 billion between 2002 and 2007.
Wow. So if revenues do slow or flatten out,
which they already have,
mm-hmm, then there will be a squeeze, presumably.
Well, we've been carrying forward what the press calls structural deficits, right, and deficit is sort of a misnomer. But what they are is lots of promises and commitments and tricks that come back to haunt. And we've had those structural problems going into every state budget since 1997. Going into the 2009 budget, the structural problem in the first year is at least $800 million. Now, to put that in some context, in good years, the state's general fund revenues probably only grow $400, $500, $600 million a year.
Right.
So we are headed for a relatively rough budget again, and unlike the last couple biennia, revenues are not going to grow by some robust number, and meanwhile the debt service keeps mounting, and right. the various accounting tricks and fund transfers keep coming back to haunt. So we certainly have held our own against the Californias and Illinois and so forth. I haven't looked at this in a couple of years, but a couple of years ago, we were one of only a couple states in the country with gap deficits on our financial statements. And in a per capita sense, we had the largest gap deficit in the country, in Wisconsin. Frugal, Norwegian, Yankee, German, Wisconsin.
Interesting. Do you have any idea how much of the debt has to be rolled over in the next year or two, and if that's going to be an issue? Or is
I really don't. I mean, a lot of there's a fair amount of the borrowing was refinancing, for instance, and issuing tobacco bonds that went out to 2018 and now are going out another 10 plus years. Certainly. Major state building projects and so forth, which are legitimate debt, are much longer too. The latest source of debt has been highway revenue bonds to backfill the transportation fund, which has been raided repeatedly.
Right. Is there any movements within Wisconsin akin to the Peterson Foundation nationally about structural deficits and debts and all these things?
Well, I like to think that the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance is probably ground zero. I'm not sure anybody else is really talking about it. I think it's interesting that when the Peterson Foundation, Concord Coalition, Brookings, Heritage crowd, very diverse philosophically, was touring the country doing a sort of a fiscal wake-up tour. When they came to Wisconsin, there were several folks on a panel in Milwaukee doing the federal thing, and I was doing the state thing for Wisconsin. And the whole sort of premise of my presentation was that behavior in Wisconsin wasn't looking that much different than behavior in Washington. It's just that Washington has perfected the art, and we're still working on it.
Well, taking baby steps. So what about property values? Mm-hmm. Do you have a feel for assessment changes and what that means?
We've really had a great run. From about 1992-93 on, we were seeing property value increases 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%, particularly in vacation second home parts of the state, recreational properties. It wasn't uncommon to see growth in the double digit percentage range each year. 2 years ago, our total property value, all classes in the state, was up over 9%. Last year, it was up over 6%. As of January of this year, it was up over 3%, which clearly shows that we have slowed. And if you look at just appreciation of existing real estate, residential, the growth was practically nothing. So we've had a good run, but we're now slowing down. The great irony is the better growth last year was not coming on the residential side, but on the business side.
Right, exactly. Is that right? Okay. And then finally, something in your most recent newsletter that was interesting about income growth. You know, Wisconsin continues to lag, in fact, maybe getting worse than national income averages.
Mm-hmm. I call per capita personal income sort of the canary in the mine shaft. Mm-hmm. And if you watch it over the last 80 years or so in Wisconsin. In the good times, we have closed to the national average or even exceeded it slightly. Generally speaking, over the last 20 years, we've closed to within 2 or 3% of the nation. There are three periods since 1929 where we have lost ground to the country. One obviously being the Depression. The second being the 81-82 manufacturing recession in the state, which was awful. Much deeper here than elsewhere. And unfortunately, the third period might be now. Because our per capita personal income, which was within 2.5% of the national average in 2003, has dropped to 6% or more below the national average, and that's a fairly fast development. And we're starting to approach levels we haven't seen in 20 years.
So why?
Well, we have a good debate about this at the office. One thing that is going on under the surface in Wisconsin that none of the political community, business, state leaders, nobody is talking about is demography. And this state is an older state, and it's going to get a lot older. The senior population will double by 2030. The school age population, which is already declining, will be stagnant. And as those folks age, the workforce will be stagnant and declining as well. So you get into a situation where you don't have as much household formation, et cetera, et cetera. Fewer cars, fewer boats, less furniture being bought, more people living on a little more carefully, and perhaps devoting a larger share of their purchases to tax-exempt items as far as the sales tax goes. So that probably is one reason, just that our income profile, the nature of our people is changing. Two other things that are worth looking at. It's very clear that our employment growth in this state peaked much sooner than the nation, probably sometime in mid-04 or into 05. The nation continued to accelerate for at least another year. So we started to decelerate much before the country, and we started contracting compared to the same month the prior year, probably late in 07 and certainly by January of 08. And the nation has lagged us there as well. So we have been slowing and much longer than the country. And when you see that kind of deceleration in employment growth, it's going to affect income. And then finally, and this just staggered me, because I had always operated under the assumption for analytical purposes that Wisconsin's wages per worker were about 10% less than the national average. And we always thought that that was because we were a manufacturing intensive state. Well, when you look at the history of wages per worker, what you find is that in 1969, we were less than 4% below the national average. After the manufacturing implosion of the early 80s, we were 10, 11% below the national average, and that's where I thought we were. However, if you look at the latest data from 2005 on, Wisconsin has wages per worker have been 14% below the national average. In other words, we have been on a 30-year slide in wages relative to the nation, and that is going to affect personal income growth too. One reason we've been able to hide it for so long is that, to put it crassly, we took our sisters, wives, mothers, and grandmothers and chained them to desks and assembly lines. In other words, the labor force participation rate of women was much higher here and much earlier, and that is what kept household incomes up while wages were eroding.
So what does Wisconsin do about this issue of the aging population? Mm-hmm. I know there's a city in Michigan, for example, that's offering college scholarships, you know, to the kids if they go to school there and all that. I mean,
we are not Nebraska, North Dakota, where you see small towns literally folding.
Right.
There are parts of the state that are doing just fine, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. If you are located in the greater sphere of Metro Chicago, Metro Minneapolis, St. Paul, Madison, suburban Milwaukee, Fox Valley, things look pretty good. Population's generally growing, income's generally growing, in some cases faster than the country. The problem is that outside this relatively narrow band of counties that runs from Green Bay down to the Milwaukee suburbs, over to Madison, and then up to the Twin Cities, everything else is pretty stagnant and declining. And so the question becomes, how do you deal with that? Clearly, having an older manufacturing-based economy, as the economy has shifted over the years, works against us. Mergers and acquisitions kill us because we're losing corporate headquarters, and with that, a lot of things. High-paid execs, high-paid staff, well-educated people, lots of philanthropy, et cetera, et cetera. Purchasing of ancillary business services, accounting, legal, whatever.
Right.
So that is certainly weighing on us. Mm-hmm. We're a relatively well-educated state with a good work ethic. I think we are slowly inventing ourselves in terms of some forms of technology. We missed the information technology boom of the 80s and 90s that Minnesota blasted off with and really departed from Wisconsin in terms of income per capita. But we do have some other things going for us in terms of medical imaging, various kinds of life sciences, and so forth. So and there certainly are venture capitalists that are realizing there are opportunities here, but we're having to reinvent ourselves at a time when other parts of the country maybe did so 20 or 30 years ago.
So what does that all mean for changes in K-12 spending? You know, you had a great chart a few weeks ago showing the splurge, the real growth in K-12 spending statewide, while UW spending was not so hot.
Well, it's fair to say that whether the state is booming as it did in the 90s or slowing as it did as it has more recently, that if there's going to be growth in any state appropriation, it's going to be state aid to schools, K-12 education, and Medicaid. And without going into the boring details of why, the way the legislature and the governor have set up those two programs, they're more or less on autopilot. And so they'll grab whatever money is available and crowd out most everything else. So you get this strange situation where state aid to schools has tripled in the last 25 years, while funding for the UW has barely doubled. Now, that sounds like a lot, except that when you look at it on a year-to-by-year basis, that means funding for the University of Wisconsin system, state funding, has grown less than the rate of inflation on an annual average basis, while school aids clearly has outpaced it, as has Medicaid. We're facing a budget crunch, but if the past is any predictor, if there's any way that the legislature and the governor can find money to do anything, they'll put it into school aids. And the school people will say it's never enough. Even though everybody else, every other state agency, technical colleges, the university, aids to municipalities and counties, all are pretty stagnant.
So is there anything on the horizon in terms of changes in sources or let's say formula, whether it's you know, there's been talk over the years about a shift to sales tax and all these things. What's the outlook for that?
Well, it depends on where you're sitting. There are some folks that think that an increased sales tax would be the panacea. When we've looked at it, however, if you take $800 million in new sales tax money and pour it into the state school aid formula, because of the way it is very powerfully redistributive in Wisconsin, you have over half the school districts in the state paying more sales tax than they would get back in new aid to schools. So, I mean, where's the benefit? And some of those are not wealthy districts, particularly second home resort areas that are maybe fairly property wealthy and would do well with extra sales tax revenue. But they end up shipping it all to Madison, and they don't fare well under the state school aid formula. More fundamentally, I really advise people who think that an increased sales tax with more money for schools is a panacea to go back and read the educational research, because it's very clear that in states where state government became even more dominant in the funding than in Wisconsin, that the net result was in the long run, a slowing of state support for schools, school funding having to compete in a legislative arena with a lot of other tough opponents, and in the end, the legislature behaving like a school board and micromanaging and mandating. And I think California's the poster child. From having arguably the best public schools in the country in the mid-late 60s, they now have probably some of the worst. They used to have the smallest class sizes. They now have the largest. And the Washington State also had a heavily state involvement over time, and it resulted in all sorts of bad news. If you want the state to raise the money, then the old golden rule applies. He who has the gold makes the rules, and that is going to mean less say for parents, local teachers, school boards, communities, and so forth. And at the worst, the picture is California or Washington.
So then we come to Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Even with revenue caps, Madison, obviously seen as a property-rich district, has been able to grow its spending at roughly 5.25% annually for 20 years, despite flat enrollment and the state laws. So how?
Well, the state revenue caps weren't biting districts as long as their enrollments were growing. So we had a real surge in school enrollment statewide in the early mid-90s. So you didn't hear much griping about revenue caps. The griping has been really since about the turn of the decade. Madison's enrollments have been fairly flat. Part of the reason has to do with the city fathers and mothers, whether it's county board, school board, or county board, making policy decisions over the last 20 to 30 years that have pretty much encouraged folks to seek out school districts in Verona, Sun Prairie, Middleton, etc., all of which are growing rapidly, all of which are competing more than adequately with the better Madison schools. A Middleton, a Wanakee, a Verona can hold their own against a Madison West or a Madison Memorial, and in many cases do better. The thing that has happened in Madison that people don't realize is at the upper level, the cream of the crop, college-bound kids, kids of professionals, faculty, are still doing extraordinarily well on national tests. And when you look just at that, Madison looks fine. The problem is the other half that doesn't take those tests. When you look at test scores in Madison compared to statewide averages at the 10th grade level or 8th grade level, it isn't pretty. Madison is in the bottom 10 to 20% while it's sitting up at the top on college entrance exams. So this is a long way of saying that to some degree, Madison has made its problem worse and has put itself on a course toward flat enrollments because of social service policies, school boundary policies, and so forth that have pushed people out of the city. Now, how have they managed to survive? Well, if there is a way within state law to get around revenue caps, Madison has been the poster child. For instance, Fund 80, the community service fund, which says if you spend property tax dollars on things that are more community-oriented than school-oriented, you don't have to put those under the revenue caps. Madison has found ways to stretch that farther than any other school district by far. And, of course, any of that spending, whether it's for a janitor who happens to clean up for a senior citizen meeting in a school or public use of a high school pool, you know, at some part of the day or whatever it is, Madison will find a way to allocate some of those expenses to the community fund that is not under the revenue caps. And beyond that, of course, Madison has had a history of passing both building and revenue cap referenda much more frequently and with much more success than most other districts. And when you look in the cost side, Madison has the most opportunity to ease the pain because it is spending more per pupil than most other districts in the state.
Right.
And no matter what the category in terms of spending per pupil, you'll always find Madison up toward the top. People think of the Milwaukee Public Schools as a high-spending district. When you really start to dig into it, what you find is that it really isn't that atypical. It's above average, but Madison's way out there compared to even MPS. People argue that MPS is top-heavy in terms of administrative costs per student. Madison actually spends more in some of those categories than Milwaukee. So it has argued that it needed a referendum relief at every turn, and it really hasn't come to grips with the kind of budget pain that some other districts really are enduring. If you go into rural, declining enrollment districts in the southwest and in northern Wisconsin, they are truly hurting. Because their enrollments are dropping. And there's no sign that they're not going to continue to drop. You have over a quarter of the school districts in this state that have had multiple years of enrollment decline. So, I can think of some school districts that over the last 10 years have lost a third of their students.
Wow.
So, you know, with that kind of dynamic, it affects your state aid adversely, it tightens your revenue cap, and it makes it a lot harder to run just school district. Much more pain than, say, Madison faces.
So thinking ahead the next 5-10 years, do you expect material change from the legislature, or would you say... this is what we've got, you know, and here we are.
Well, the last time we pretty much blew up the school finance system in Wisconsin was in 94, and it happened very quickly within a span of 2 to 3 months, and it had everything to do with partisan political gotcha, and it had nothing to do with education.
Right.
And so arguments that we may need to rethink school finance in this state for educational reasons or policy reasons aren't as relevant as has there been a partisan political change that motivates somebody to, in the vernacular, screw somebody else.
Right, right.
There's been a lot of talk about changing the revenue caps of the QEO. There are some changes that could be made that would make those policies sustainable and work better. And we've known that for over a decade, and yet one side or the other of the aisle doesn't seem to want to move there. They're more interested in scoring partisan points. If you had a governor and both houses of the legislature controlled by one party, then clearly if they really want to do something, they're in a position to do it. But the interesting thing about school aid politics in Wisconsin is you have... where are the two bastions of Democratic seats in the legislature, Madison and Milwaukee?
Right.
Madison is property rich. Milwaukee is relatively property poor. Somehow you've got to reconcile those two within a Democratic environment. And on the Republican side, you have property-rich suburbs and some very property-poor rural districts. And so it's not at all clear that they can sing off the same page of the hymnal either. So this stuff is a lot more complicated than just pure political power as well.
Well, thank you so much, Todd.
You're very welcome.
It.